Sunday evening, our study of elders, and we began last Sunday evening looking at the qualifications for those that would serve as elders. And I wanted to make mention, I am taping these lessons because a person or two were not going to be able to be here, so I was taping them for them. But if you've missed a lesson, want to hear the rest of them, let me know. I'll do what I can to provide you with a CD. Or I hope to maybe be able to just put them online and tell you where to go to access them there, if you're able to do it that way. But anyway, we're going to try to continue to tape them and make them available as the need may be. But we began, again, looking last Sunday evening at the qualifications for those who would serve us as elders so that we can know what we need to be looking for in the men of this congregation, so the men can know what they need to improve in their own lives so that down the road they would themselves be qualified to serve in this particular area of work. And so we began last Sunday evening, looking at that. And we only looked at three quick areas last week. We spent our time looking at a number of different things as way of introduction to these qualifications. But then we did look at three of the qualifications just briefly. For one, that he must be that he must be a man, that he must be one who desires the office or the work of an elder, and thirdly, that he must be blameless. Those were the three that we spent our time looking at last Sunday evening. The qualifications of elders, it's an important thing for us to look at, to remind ourselves of. Those of us that have gone over it before, we need to be reminded of these things. But, sometimes we find ourselves looking at these qualifications through colored glasses, through the glass of our experiences with elders. Maybe we've been somewhere where they had elders that shouldn't have been, men serving as elders who shouldn't have been. Maybe they acted in a way that they shouldn't have in some ways. Maybe they were guilty of lording it over the charge allotted to them, as we saw Peter warning about that. Maybe they were bad elders in one way or another, and thus we are much stricter on the qualifications as maybe we ought to be. We've got to be careful that we try to view these qualifications in the proper light. As I have said, whatever the minimum requirement is to have the particular quality under consideration is all that is required. But there may be greater levels to which a man could meet those particular qualifications even still. But let's go ahead and go through these. Work through some more of these this evening. And again, we're taking them in the order that they are found in 1 Timothy 3 or in Titus chapter 1. And because of one tonight that we're going to look at, we're going to go ahead and pull some in out of Titus rather than continuing on with the list in 1 Timothy. But we begin, though, with the one that says that he must be the husband of one wife. And that's the way it's worded there in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in verse 2, the husband of one wife. The New English Bible says faithful to his one wife. The Revised Standard Version, married only once. And really surrounding this one qualification, a great deal of controversy has arisen through the years among brethren in trying to interpret and decide what it does and doesn't include, and we're not going to be able to answer all those questions tonight. We'll raise a couple of questions and throw out some ideas, but we won't be able to settle these issues. Not going to be trying. But let's do understand what is basically being required by this qualification. I would suggest, first of all, that the brother must be married. That's simple enough. If he's going to be the husband of one wife, that necessitates that he be a husband, that he be married. Therefore, he cannot be a bachelor. Someone who is a bachelor, who is unmarried, no matter how righteous, no matter how pious and studious, no matter how worthy of a child of God that he might be, he's not qualified to be appointed to the office of elder to serve in that capacity in the Lord's church. Interestingly, Roman Catholicism has their priests, and they are forbidden to be married. And above them is what they call the bishop, which is another one of the biblical terms used interchangeably with the word elder. And yet they are not permitted to be married. So it's interesting that in their line of thinking, they forbid the very thing that is required of one to serve as an elder, and that is that he be married. But also, we should understand that he must be married to a woman. He is to be the husband of one wife, which is a woman. And unfortunately, we even have to make that point, but in our day of time and of gay marriage and the like, then we need to make that point. But also, he cannot be a polygamist. He's to be the husband of one wife. He can't be the husband of multiple wives. And sadly, there are many places where that is the practice of some. But what Paul says here would seem in my mind to preclude a man who is guilty of polygamy from serving in the capacity of an elder in the local church. So this qualification is both positive and negative. It's positive in that it requires marriage, but it's negative in that it forbids polygamous marriages, a man in such a marriage to be considered to serve as an elder. Now, I said I was going to throw out a couple of questions. There are a lot of questions that come up about this qualification and considering a man to serve as an elder. And I'm going to only briefly look at two of these questions. One question is this: can he be in a second marriage? Can he be in a second marriage? And I'm going to answer this in two ways. No, he cannot. And then I'll answer it, yes, he can. No, he cannot be in a second marriage if his first marriage did not end because of fornication, Matthew 19, verse 9, or his wife hasn't died. So, he's married for reasons, other than what the Lord would permit. You remember Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 12, Jesus addressed the question about marriage, and that marriage is permanent. It's one man for one woman for life. And in Matthew chapter 19, what did he say in verse 9 of that chapter? He said, I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And he that marrieth her when she is put away, committeth adultery. And so you cannot divorce and remarry without becoming guilty of adultery unless you have put your mate away because they were guilty of adultery. And you remarry, then and only then would you not be guilty of adultery. So if you have not put away your mate for adultery, or your marriage didn't end because of the death of your mate, and now you're in a second marriage, then no, you would not be qualified, to serve as an elder. You have no right to that situation. But I answer yes. If in fact you did put away your mate because they were guilty of adultery, or your mate died, and then subsequent to that you again entered into a marriage relationship. The first mate, has been put away for fornication, or they have died, and therefore you are free in the sight of God to be married to another. And therefore you would not be guilty of sin in marrying another. You would be again, the husband of one wife, should you find yourself remarried in that situation. Those are my thoughts on that matter. But the second question I wanted to throw out that is often raised is, can a brother who is serving as an elder continue to serve as an elder if his wife dies? And I'm going to just throw out the arguments that are made on both sides of that issue. Those who would say that no, he cannot continue to serve as an elder, they argue that a widower is no longer a husband. And Paul says that he must be, present tense, that he must be the husband of one wife in order to be an elder. And thus it is concluded that he's no longer qualified to serve and ought to step down if his wife dies. And a lot of brethren in a lot of places feel that away. The argument is also made that indeed he could continue to serve as an elder, even though his wife has died. Adam Clark, in his comments, said this. He said, a man is no less qualified because his wife dies than he is if his children are killed or die. And he went on to say, if a man was truly qualified to be an elder of a church, with his wife and children faithfully serving God at the time of his recognition, selection, and appointment to the eldership, he is no less qualified if, unfortunately, one or all of them die. It is also argued that such would make him better fitted and qualified to serve as an elder in the sense that he has personally suffered the sorrow of losing a mate, and therefore he can more readily relate with those in the congregation who might be going through such a thing. It is argued that if a brother, as an elder, should become unqualified, he ought to resign from the office of an elder, but that the death of his mate does not constitute anything wrong that he has done, of course. It's not an act of sin that he has been guilty of. It doesn't constitute unfaithfulness on his part in any way. And thus, it is thought that he should not resign. I do want to point out one passage of Scripture also here in 1 Timothy. Consider 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 9. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 9. Paul is talking about widows. And he says, let none be enrolled as a widow under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man. Now, what I want to draw your attention to in this verse is the phrase, having been. It may be in italics in your translation, or in parenthesis, or something of that nature to indicate that it's been added by the translators. It's not in the original language. So therefore, let us read it with that without the added words. Let none be enrolled as a widow under 80 years old, the wife of one man. Her husband is dead. And yet she's still being described as being the wife of one man. And again, this is in the same context as what Paul has to say in chapter 3. And so since this phrase, similar in nature to the husband of one wife, since it is applied to a woman whose husband is dead, then it is argued that a brother whose wife has died could continue to serve as an elder, since the same type of phrase could be said of him. There are other arguments involved in this, but those are the basic arguments on the two sides of that. And I'll leave the rest for you to decide on that. But let us not become so involved in the controversial issues surrounding any of these qualifications that we lose sight of what is required of the man without question. And in this particular one, it's required that he be married. He be married to a woman, of course, that he be married only to one woman and not be guilty of polygamy. But let's move on. Let's go to the next one that we want to talk about, and that's the idea of being vigilant. Vigilant. The King James says a bishop then must be vigilant. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in verse 2. The American Standard, though, uses the word temperate, and then the New English Bible uses the word sober. Now, these three words, they're closely related, but they have slightly different meanings. But yet, we're in the English, we're going to find these same words as translations for the different Greek words that are used here. There's only one Greek word that is used that is being translated by these different versions by these three different words. But the Greek word means sober, temperate, abstaining from wine, either entirely or at least from its immoderate use. That's Thayer. The analytical Greek lexicon says sober, temperate, abstinent in respect to wine. In the New Testament, metaphorically, vigilant, circumspect. Strong's Concordance says sober, that is figuratively circumspect. And so it carries more, as we'll establish, more really than just the idea of sobriety. Sobriety in the sense of, using alcohol. In a summary of sorts of these three words, temperate means the moderation of anything without specific regard for the cause or effect. It means not excessive as regards anything. Sober also means moderation, but it includes, in addition, the cause of moderation, a self-possessed person who is free from anything that would hinder temperance. Vigilant, likewise, carries the idea of moderation and the cause of such, but it goes even further to include also the results of soberness, the ability to watch and discover anger, discover danger, rather. And so you see some of the differences between them, though. So an elder must be one who can, as a result of being temperate and sober, be able to watch for danger in the church. And we've already talked about in our lessons already about the kind of dangers that they're to be looking for. They're to be looking for the dangers that come to the souls of those in the flock. They're watching in behalf of our souls. We talked about that somewhat in our lesson even this morning. They're watching for our souls. They're watching for the needs that we have, and to meet those needs, they are watchful over us. And that's a big part of what's being talked about here. So this clearly, it requires a clear, vigilant mind, unhampered by drunkenness or self-ego. It means that the bishop must be self-controlled, watchful, alert, having a foresight to know the end of a course before it is begun. A man who has developed this quality of being able to watch himself and watch others, as we have already talked about somewhat. I made the point last week that most all of these qualifications are required of all of us, and that's certainly true of this one. All Christians are to be as described here. 1 Peter chapter 5 and in verse 8, he said, "Be sober, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour." We're to be sober. That's the Greek word here that is translated by these three words. And so we are to be vigilant. But now the next one we want to talk about, going over to Titus, is the word temperate. Titus 1 and verse 8, the King James now uses the word temperate, whereas it used vigilant for the previous one. But temperate was one of the other translations uses, or translations of that Greek word. And so we'll go ahead and consider it out of order, since it's so closely related to what we just talked about. But temperate, the American Standard has self-controlled, the English Standard disciplined. And so it carries the idea of discipline, the idea of self-control. A man who would serve as a bishop in the Lord's church must be a man of ability to control himself, be able to control his thoughts, his passions, his activities, what he does with his energies. He's to be able to control himself. He must be able to control himself in that which is lawful, and keep himself from those things that are not lawful, those things that are prohibited from God. And so among those things that are lawful, that we're permitted to do, he's able, though, to control himself in those areas, able to keep himself under control. And I've got some passages there. Proverbs 16 and verse 32. Back in Proverbs 16, verse 32, he said, "He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city." It's better to be able to rule our spirit, to have control over ourselves, than to be able to be strong and take a city. In Proverbs 25 and verse 28, it says, "He whose spirit is without restraint is like a city that is broken down and without walls." Well, we're to have a spirit that has constraints or restraints. But then, of course, James chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. In James 1, 19 and 20, he says, "You know this, my beloved brethren, but let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God." We're to be slow to speak, slow to wrath, and that means self-control. We've got to control ourselves, control the things that come out of our mouth, control our attitudes, control our temper that may come into play. And that's really our next point there. We're to control our temper and our tongue. Proverbs 10, going back to Proverbs again, two more passages in Proverbs. In Proverbs 10 and verse 19, the wise preacher Solomon said, "In the multitude of words there wanteth not transgression, but he that refraineth his lips doeth wisely." We need to learn how to refrain our lips. You know, we all talk too much. We all say things, you know, off the cuff and end up saying things that we regret, things that we wish we hadn't said, because we're so quick to try to get words out. And we don't think them through as much as we should. We need to start thinking more and speaking less to make sure that what's coming out of our mouth is the kind of things that ought to be said. Elders are going to have that quality. They're going to have to be able to be temperate, to be able to control themselves. You know, anyone who's in any kind of a leadership role or position in life, they're going to be susceptible to be on the receiving end of just petty criticisms. And it's hard. It's hard to not respond. It's hard not to sometimes come back with strong words to counter what's been said against us. Well, an elder has to be able to do that. They have to have that control of their spirit, that they'll not charge back against another even on those times. Well, again, it's required of all of us. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6, Peter said, "And in your knowledge, self-control, in your self-control patience, and in your patience godliness," so on, talking about, our faith and, building our faith. And among the things that are to be added, we're to add to our knowledge, self-control, the ability to control ourselves, the ability to be temperate, as he speaks of it here. But another of those words that were used under vigilant was the word sober. And again, 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, the King James says, though, of good behavior. I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself there. The King James rather says sober. The American Standard has sober-minded. The Revised Standard Version has sensible. The New English Bible, temperate. And the New American Standard Version has the word prudent. The Greek word that is used for that is translated sober here, H.E. Phillips in his comments said that it means discreet, prudent, moderate, temperate, chaste, sober, of sound mind, sane, in one's senses, curbing one's desires and impulses. And so the idea of this qualification is a brother who is a clear thinker, one who is of sound mind and well-balanced in his thought processes, possessing good common sense in a lot of ways. Remember over in Mark chapter 5 and in verse 15. In Mark 5 and in verse 15, it says, "And they come to Jesus, and behold him that was possessed with demons sitting, clothed, and in his right mind, even him that had the legion, and they were afraid." He was in his right mind. Well, we need to make sure we are appointing men who are always in their right mind. They're sober-minded. They have control of their thought processes. They're able to think in a sober way all the time. So the word does not just mean one who has has become drunk with wine, one who has not done that, rather, though it certainly includes that. You know, when we think of the word sober, we think of someone who's not intoxicated. It includes that, but it includes more than that. It's much more inclusive and comprehensive than that. It's the quality to remain calm, even tempered, cautious, wise, full control of the mind and body, as we've been discussing. Indeed, what wonderful qualities to find in these men. These are important qualities, that they be vigilant and temperate and sober. And these are the kind of men that we're looking for to direct, to oversee, to rule in the local congregation, as God's servants, as elders in the congregation. They've got to be clear-headed, possessed of good judgment, not intoxicated physically or mentally. Again, we can make the same point about all of us. These are things that are to be found of all of us. Just notice in Romans chapter 12 and in verse 3. Just in Romans 12 and in verse 3, Paul says, "For I say, through the grace that was given me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think as to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to each man a measure of faith." In Titus 2, in verses 1 through 6, three times he makes reference to them, the need for them to be sober-minded. We all are to be sober-minded, but we especially need to find those men in our congregation who are sober-minded, who can serve in this capacity of as elders in the body of Christ. But let's go on. And we do want to talk about the idea of being of good behavior. And there in verse 2, the King James uses that phrase of good behavior. The American Standard, though, says orderly. New English Bible says courteous. The Revised Standard Version says dignified. The New American Standard Version says respectable. And so we have those different translations, and sometimes just the translations are helpful in understanding what the Greek words there mean. Thayer, though, in the regards to the Greek word used here, says that it means well-arranged, seemly, modest, of a man living with decorum, a well-ordered life. And something similar is offered by Vine in his Dictionary of New Testament Words. But the type of man described here is well-arranged, dignified, courteous, a chaste man in just the whole manner of his life. And so he's going to be a well-respected person all around in all of his activities. He's going to be, if he's in business, he's going to be the kind of business person that people love doing business with, because they know he's going to conduct business honestly and appropriately, that he's going to certainly be courteous and kind and in every way imaginable. He's going to be the kind of person people will want to conduct business with. A fellow by the name of Gene Taylor summarized it all this way. He says, the type of man described by this qualification is well-arranged, dignified, courteous, and chaste in his whole manner of life, honest, fair, and diligent in business, kind, courteous, and polite in language, neither sour, rude, gruff, sharp, nor cutting, clean and moderate in his habits, a well-behaved person in all phases of his life. So that's the kind of person we're looking for. Over in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 34, Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And so a man is going to show by his words what's in his heart. He's going to show by his words whether he possesses this and the other qualities that are being sought to be elders in the church. We'll be able to see in part what's in his heart by the words that he uses. And of course, someone who doesn't meet this qualification shouldn't be appointed, of course. Again, it is found with regards to not just elders. It is used with regards to the apparel that Christian women are to wear. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 9 said, in like manner that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. That word for modest is the same word that is used here for good behavior. And so well-ordered, dignified, all the things that we have just been talking about, spoken of with regards to the kind of apparel a woman is to wear. The last thing we'll focus on our attention this evening is that of being given to hospitality. The New American Standard and New English Bible translate it rather as hospitable. And I have forgotten what NTBE stands for, but they translated it opening his house freely to guests. And so he's a man who is hospitable. He's generous to his guests, to pick up the definition from Thayer. He's given to hospitality. You know, our word of hospitality, Webster defines the word hospitable, as we use it in our language today, as receiving and entertaining strangers with kindness and without regard, without reward, kind to strangers and guests, disposed to treat guests with generous kindness. Well, those men that would serve as elders in the Lord's church, indeed, they're to have those qualities. They're to be kind and generous, entertaining to guests and strangers. We're going to talk later about the wives of the elders. There's some qualifications for them as well given in 1 Timothy 3. And so it should be easy for us to see and understand why she is involved in this as well, because they are partners together in this process. And the hospitality that he offers would be helped greatly by his loving wife, no doubt. But this means, more than just inviting, the preacher or a good friend into your home and treating someone you want to impress or someone that you really like, to a meal. Bringing strangers into your home. We live in a day and time when we're afraid of strangers. We raise our children to be wary of strangers. And we've grown up to be wary of strangers. And yet that's part of the concept of hospitality, being willing to open our hearts and our homes, our being generous with those who are even strangers to us in their times of need. But notice that he's to be given to hospitality. He's not going to be hospitable just because it's one of the requirements to be able to serve as an elder. He's not going to be hospitable just because it's one of the qualifications or just because people are expecting that of him. Hospitality should be something that he enjoys and delights in. He's given to it. It's a part of him to be hospitable to others. You remember the story of the Good Samaritan over in Luke chapter 10. He showed himself to be a neighbor. He showed himself to be hospitable by taking care of the man who had been beaten and left for dead. He took care of him and showed hospitality toward him. And that's certainly the way in which this man is to be. We're all to be thoughtful of others, manifest that towards all, but especially those that are to be considered as elders in the Lord's church. Of course, it is required of all of us, this particular one. Romans 12 and verse 13, communicating to the necessities of the saints, given to hospitality, speaking to all of us. Galatians 6 and verse 10, so then as we have opportunity, let us work that which is good toward all men, and especially toward them that are of the household of faith. We're to use hospitality one to another without murmuring, 1 Peter 4 and verse 9. We're to be hospitable, but especially those who would serve in the body of Christ as elders in the Lord's church. And so we'll stop with that for tonight. We have more that we'll be looking at next Lord's Day evening and probably another one after that. There's so many of them. But I hope that the way in which we're going about this will prove helpful as we seek to just generally go over these qualifications and without getting burdened down with too many things pertaining to them. There is more than enough material for us to study as a class for several months. We've done that back in Clay where we moved here from. We did it that away there and got into a lot deeper things there. And that's good too, but we're trying to just go over things in a general quick way to be helpful for us to have a general concept of what's under consideration here to help you in your own studies as you study these in your own time. That's what we're seeking to do. Well, we don't want to end without extending an invitation to those that may be in the audience this evening who need to respond. If your life is not as it needs to be in God's sight, you need to do something about that. You need to do something about that even tonight. If you've never obeyed the gospel of Christ, go away tonight as a child of God. Render obedience unto his commands. Become a Christian. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, you have the right to become a child of God. If you believe in him enough to repent and to turn from your sins, to confess your faith to others, to join him in his death, burial, and resurrection, you can become a Christian even tonight. If you've not been living like you should, get things right with God tonight. We'd be happy to pray for you if you'd like. Let your wishes be known. While together we're standing, while we're singing.